backward through the air, landing hard on the artificial turf. Before he could even take a breath, powerful hands flipped him onto his stomach, twisted his left arm behind his back, and pressed an iron palm onto the back of his head, leaving Langdon totally immobilized, with his left cheek squashed into the turf.
"You knew about this before it happened," the guard shouted. "How are you involved?"
20 yards away, Guardia Real agent Rafa Diaz scrambled through throngs of fleeing guests and tried to reach the spot on the side wall where he had seen the flash of a gunshot. "Ambra Vidal is safe," he assured himself, having seen his partner pull her to the floor and cover her body with his own. In addition, Diaz felt certain there was nothing to be done for the victim. Edmund Kirsch was dead before he hit the ground. Eerily, Diaz noted, one of the guests appeared to have had advance warning of the attack, rushing the podium only an instant before the gunshot. Whatever the reason, Diaz knew it could wait. At the moment, he had only one task: apprehend the shooter. As Diaz arrived at the site of the telltale flash, he found a slit in the fabric wall and plunged his hand through the opening, violently tearing the hole all the way down to the floor and clambering out of the dome into a maze of scaffolding. To his left, the agent caught a glimpse of a figure, a tall man dressed in a white military uniform, sprinting toward the emergency exit at the far side of the enormous space. An instant later, the fleeing figure crashed through the door and disappeared. Diaz gave pursuit, weaving through the electronics outside the dome and finally bursting through the door into a cement stairwell. He peered over the railing and saw the fugitive 2 floors below, spiraling downward at breakneck speed. Diaz raced after him, leaping 5 stairs at a time. Somewhere below, the exit door crashed open loudly and then slammed shut again.
"He's exited the building."
When Diaz reached the ground floor, he sprinted to the exit, a pair of double doors with horizontal pushbars, and threw all of his weight into them. The doors, rather than flying open like those upstairs, moved only an inch and then jammed to a stop. Diaz's body crashed into the wall of steel, and he landed in a heap, a searing pain erupting in his shoulder. Shaken, he pulled himself up and tried the doors again. They opened just far enough to allow him to glimpse the problem. Strangely, the outer door handles had been bound shut by a loop of wire, a string of beads wrapped around the handles from the outside. Diaz's confusion deepened when he realized the pattern of the beads was quite familiar to him, as it would be to any good Spanish Catholic. "Is that a rosary?" Using all of his force, Diaz heaved his aching body into the doors again, but the string of beads refused to break. He stared again through the narrow opening, baffled both by the presence of a rosary and also by his inability to break it.
"Hola!"
he shouted through the doors.
"Hay alguien!"
Silence. Through the slit in the doors, Diaz could make out a high concrete wall and a deserted service alley. Chances were slim that anyone would be coming by to remove the loop. Seeing no other option, he grabbed his handgun from the holster beneath his blazer. He cocked the weapon and extended the barrel through the doorway slit. He pressed the muzzle into the string of rosary beads.
"I'm firing a bullet into a holy rosary? Que Dios me perdone."
The remaining pieces of the crucifix bobbed up and down before Diaz's eyes. He pulled the trigger. The gunshot thundered in the cement landing, and the doors flew open. The rosary shattered, and Diaz lurched forward, staggering out into the empty alley as rosary beads bounced across the pavement all around him. The assassin in white was gone. 100 meters away, Admiral Luis Avila sat in silence in the back seat of the black Renault that now accelerated away from the museum. The tensile strength of the Vectran fiber on which Avila had strung the rosary beads had done its job, delaying his pursuers just long enough. "And now I am gone." As Avila's car sped northwest along the meandering Nervión River and disappeared among the fast-moving cars on the Avenida Abando Ibarra, Admiral Avila finally permitted himself to exhale. His mission tonight could not have gone any more smoothly. In his mind, he began to hear the joyful strains of the Oriamendi hymn, its age-old lyrics once sung in bloody battle right here in Bilbao. Por Dios, por la patria y el rey, Avila sang in his mind. For God, for country, and king. The battle cry had long since been forgotten, but the war had just begun. Chapter 22. Madrid's Palacio Real is Europe's largest royal palace, as well as one of its most stunning architectural fusions of classical and Baroque styles. Built on the site of a 9th-century Moorish castle, the palace's three-story facade of columns spans the entire 500-foot width of the sprawling Plaza de la Armería, on which it sits. The interior is a mind-boggling labyrinth of 3,418 rooms that wind through almost 1.5 million square feet of floor space. The salons, bedrooms, and hallways are adorned with a collection of priceless religious art, including masterpieces by Velázquez, Goya, and Rubens. For generations, the palace had been the private residence of Spanish kings and queens. Now, however, it was used primarily for state functions, with the royal family taking residence in the more casual and secluded Palacio de la Zarzuela, outside the city. In recent months, however, Madrid's formal palace had become the permanent home for Crown Prince Julian, the 42-year-old future king of Spain, who had moved into the palace at the behest of his handlers, who wanted Julian to be more visible to the country during this somber period prior to his eventual coronation. Prince Julian's father, the current king, had been bedridden for months with a terminal illness. As the fading king's mental faculties eroded, the palace had begun the slow transfer of power, preparing the prince to ascend to the throne once his father passed. With a shift in leadership now imminent, Spaniards had turned their eyes to Crown Prince Julian, with a single question on their minds. What kind of ruler will he turn out to be? Prince Julian had always been a discreet and cautious child, having borne the weight of his eventual sovereignty since boyhood. Julian's mother had died from preterm complications while carrying her second child, and the king, to the surprise of many, had chosen never to remarry, leaving Julian the lone successor to the Spanish throne. An heir with no spare, the UK tabloids coldly called the prince. Because Julian had matured under the wing of his deeply conservative father, most traditionalist Spaniards believed he would continue their king's austere tradition of preserving the dignity of the Spanish crown through maintaining established conventions, celebrating ritual, and above all, remaining ever reverential to Spain's rich Catholic history. For centuries, the legacy of the Catholic kings had served as Spain's moral center. In recent years, though, the country's bedrock of faith seemed to be dissolving, and Spain found herself locked in a violent tug of war between the very old and the very new. A growing number of liberals were now flooding blogs and social media with rumors suggesting that once Julian was finally able to emerge from his father's shadow, he would reveal his true self, a bold, progressive, secular leader, finally willing to follow the lead of so many European countries and abolish the monarchy entirely. Julian's father had always been very active in his role as king, leaving Julian little room to participate in politics. The king openly stated that he believed Julian should enjoy his youth, and not until the prince was married and settled down did it make sense for him to engage in matters of state. And so Julian's first 40 years, endlessly chronicled in the Spanish press, had been a life of private schools, horseback riding, ribbon cuttings, fundraisers, and world travel.
Despite having accomplished little of note in his life, Prince Julian was, without a doubt, Spain's most eligible bachelor. Over the years, the handsome 42-year-old prince had publicly dated countless eligible women, and while he had a reputation for being a hopeless romantic, nobody had ever quite stolen his heart. In recent months, however, Julian had been spotted several times with a beautiful woman who, despite looking like a retired fashion model, was in fact the highly respected director of Bilbao's Guggenheim Museum. The media immediately hailed Ambra Vidal as a perfect match for a modern king. She was cultured, successful, and, most importantly, not a scion of one of Spain's noble families. Ambra Vidal was of the people. The prince apparently agreed with their assessment, and after only a very short courtship, Julian proposed to her in a most unexpected and romantic way, and Ambra Vidal accepted. In the weeks that followed, the press reported daily on Ambra Vidal, noting that she was turning out to be much more than a pretty face. She quickly revealed herself as a fiercely independent woman who, despite being the future queen consort of Spain, flatly refused to permit the Guardia Real to interfere with her daily schedule or let their agents provide her with protection at anything other than a major public event. When the commander of the Guardia Real discreetly suggested Ambra start wearing clothing that was more conservative and less form-fitting, Ambra made a public joke out of it, saying she had been reprimanded by the commander of the Guardarropa Real, the royal wardrobe. The liberal magazines splashed her face all over their covers. Ambra, Spain's beautiful future. When she refused an interview, they hailed her as independent. When she granted an interview, they hailed her as accessible. Conservative magazines countered by deriding the brash new queen-to-be as a power-hungry opportunist who would be a dangerous influence on the future king. As evidence, they cited her blatant disregard for the prince's reputation. Their initial concern centered on Ambra's habit of addressing Prince Julian by his first name alone, eschewing the traditional custom of referring to him as Don Julian or Su Alteza. Their second concern, however, seemed far more serious. For the past several weeks, Ambra's work schedule had made her almost entirely unavailable to the prince, and yet she had been cited repeatedly in Bilbao, having lunch near the museum with an outspoken atheist, American technologist Edmund Kirsch. Despite Ambra's insistence that the lunches were simply planning meetings with one of the museum's major donors, sources inside the palace suggested that Julian's blood was beginning to boil. Not that anyone could blame him. The truth of the matter was that Julian's stunning fiancée, only weeks after their engagement, had been choosing to spend most of her time with another man. Chapter 23. Langdon's face remained pressed hard into the turf. The weight of the agent on top of him was crushing. Strangely, he felt nothing. Langdon's emotions were scattered and numb, twisting layers of sadness, fear, and outrage. One of the world's most brilliant minds, a dear friend, had just been publicly executed in the most brutal manner. He was killed only moments before he revealed the greatest discovery of his life. Langdon now realized that the tragic loss of human life was accompanied by a second loss, a scientific one. Now the world may never know what Edmund found. Langdon flushed with sudden anger, followed by steely determination. I will do everything possible to find out who is responsible for this. I will honor your legacy, Edmund. I will find a way to share your discovery with the world.
You knew,
the guard's voice rasped close in his ear.
You were heading for the podium like you expected something to happen.
I was warned, Langdon managed, barely able to breathe.
Warned? By whom?
Langdon could feel his transducer headset twisted and askew on his cheek.
The headset on my face. It's an automated docent. Edmund Kirsch's computer warned me. It found an anomaly on the guest list, a retired admiral from the Spanish Navy.
The guard's head was now close enough to Langdon's ear that he could hear the man's radio earpiece crackle to life. The voice in the transmission was breathless and urgent, and although Langdon's Spanish was spotty, he heard enough to decipher the bad news.
El asesino ha huido.
The assassin had escaped.
Salida bloqueada.
An exit had been blocked.
Uniforme militar blanco.
As the words military uniform were spoken, the guard on top of Langdon eased off the pressure.
Uniforme naval?
He asked his partner.
Blanco, como de almirante?
The response was affirmative. A naval uniform, Langdon realized. Winston was right. The guard released Langdon and got off him.
Roll over.
Langdon twisted painfully onto his back and propped himself up on his elbows. His head was spinning and his chest felt bruised.
Don't move,
the guard said. Langdon had no intention of moving. The officer standing over him was about 200 pounds of solid muscle and had already shown he was dead serious about his job.
Immediatamente,
the guard barked into his radio, continuing with an urgent request for support from local authorities and roadblocks around the museum.
Policía local. Bloqueos de carretera.
From his position on the floor, Langdon could see Ambra Vidal, still on the ground near the sidewall. She tried to stand up, but faltered, collapsing on her hands and knees. Somebody help her. But the guard was now shouting across the dome, seeming to address nobody in particular.
Luces! Y cobertura de móvil!
I need lights and phone service. Langdon reached up and straightened the transducer headset on his face.
Winston, are you there?
The guard turned, eyeing Langdon strangely.
I am here.
Winston's voice was flat.
Winston, Edmund was shot. We need the lights back on right away. We need cellular service restored. Can you control that, or contact someone who can?
Seconds later, the lights in the dome rose abruptly, dissolving the magical illusion of a moonlit meadow and illuminating a deserted expanse of artificial turf scattered with abandoned blankets. The guard seemed startled by Langdon's apparent power. After a moment, he reached down and pulled Langdon to his feet. The two men faced each other in the stark light. The agent was tall, the same height as Langdon, with a shaved head and a muscular body that strained at his blue blazer. His face was pale with muted features that set off his sharp eyes, which at the moment were focused like lasers on Langdon.
You were in the video tonight. You're Robert Langdon.
Yes, Edmund Kirsch was my student and friend.
I am Agent Fonseca. With the Guardia Real,
he announced in perfect English.
Tell me how you knew about the Navy uniform.
Langdon turned toward Edmund's body, which lay motionless on the grass beside the podium. Ambra Vidal knelt beside the body along with two museum security guards and a staff paramedic who had already abandoned efforts to revive him. Ambra gently covered the corpse with a blanket. Clearly, Edmund was gone. Langdon felt nauseated, unable to pull his eyes from his murdered friend.
We can't help him, the guard snapped. Tell me how you knew.
Langdon returned his eyes to the guard, whose tone left no room for misinterpretation. It was an order. Langdon quickly relayed what Winston had told him, that the docent program had flagged one of the guests' headsets as having been abandoned, and when a human docent found the headset in a trash receptacle, they checked which guest had been assigned that headset, alarmed to find that he was a last-minute write-in on the guest list.
Impossible.
The guard's eyes narrowed.
The guest list was locked yesterday. Everyone underwent a background check.
Not this man, Winston's voice announced in Langdon's headset. I was concerned and ran the guest's name, only to find he was a former Spanish Navy admiral, discharged for alcoholism and post-traumatic stress, suffered in a terrorist attack in Seville 5 years ago.
Langdon relayed the information to the guard.
The bombing of the cathedral?
The guard looked incredulous. Furthermore, Winston told Langdon, I found the officer had no connection whatsoever to Mr. Kirsch, which concerned me, and so I contacted museum security to set off alarms, but without more conclusive information, they argued we should not ruin Edmund's event, especially while it was being live-streamed to the world. Knowing how hard Edmund worked on tonight's program, their logic made sense to me, and so I immediately contacted you, Robert, in hopes you could spot this man so I could discreetly guide a security team to him. I should have taken stronger action. I failed Edmund. Langdon found it somewhat unnerving that Edmund's machine seemed to experience guilt. He glanced back toward Edmund's covered body and saw Ambra Vidal approaching. Fonseca ignored her, still focused directly on Langdon.
The computer, he asked. Did it give you a name for the naval officer in question?
Langdon nodded. His name is Admiral Luis Avila. As he spoke the name, Ambra stopped short and stared at Langdon, a look of utter horror on her face. Fonseca noted her reaction and immediately moved toward her.
Miss Vidal, you're familiar with the name?
Ambra seemed unable to reply. She lowered her gaze and stared at the floor as if she had just seen a ghost.
Miss Vidal, Fonseca repeated, Admiral Luis Avila. Do you know this name?
Ambra's shell-shocked expression left little doubt that she did indeed know the killer. After a stunned moment, she blinked twice, and her dark eyes began to clear, as if she were emerging from a trance.
No, I don't know the name,
she whispered, glancing at Langdon and then back at her security guard.
I was just shocked to hear that the killer was an officer of the Spanish Navy.
She's lying, Langdon sensed, puzzled as to why she would attempt to disguise her reaction. I saw it. She recognized that man's name.
Who was in charge of the guest list? Fonseca demanded, taking another step toward Ambra. Who added this man's name?
Ambra's lips were trembling now.
I have no idea.
The guard's questions were interrupted by a sudden cacophony of cell phones ringing and beeping throughout the dome. Winston had apparently found a way to restore cell service, and one of the phones now ringing was in Fonseca's blazer pocket. The Guardia agent reached for his phone and, seeing the caller ID, took a deep breath and answered,
Ambra Vidal está a salvo, he announced.
Ambra Vidal is safe. Langdon moved his gaze to the distraught woman. She was already looking at him. When their eyes met, they held each other's stare for a long moment. Then Langdon heard Winston's voice materialize in his headset.
Professor, Winston whispered, Ambra Vidal knows very well how Luis Avila got onto the guest list. She added his name herself.
Langdon needed a moment to make sense of the information. Ambra Vidal herself placed the killer on the guest list? And now she's lying about it? Before Langdon could fully process this information, Fonseca was handing his cell phone to Ambra. The agent said,
Don Julian quiere hablar con usted.
Ambra seemed almost to recoil from the phone.
Tell him I'm fine, she replied. I'll call him in a little while.
The guard's expression was one of utter disbelief. He covered the phone and whispered to Ambra,
Su Alteza Don Julian, el Príncipe, ha pedido...
I don't care if he's the prince, she fired back. If he's going to be my husband, he will have to learn to give me space when I need it. I just witnessed a murder, and I need a minute to myself. Tell him I'll call him shortly.
Fonseca stared at the woman, his eyes flashing an emotion that bordered on contempt. Then he turned and walked off to continue his call in private. For Langdon, the bizarre exchange had solved one small mystery. Ambra Vidal is engaged to Prince Julian of Spain?
This news explained the celebrity treatment she was receiving, and also the presence of the Guardia Real, although it certainly did not explain her refusal to accept her fiancé's call. The prince must be worried to death if he saw this on television. Almost instantly, Langdon was struck by a second, far darker revelation. Oh my God. Ambra Vidal is connected to Madrid's royal palace. The unexpected coincidence sent a chill through him as he recalled Edmund's threatening voicemail from Bishop Valdespino. Chapter 24. 200 yards from Madrid's royal palace, inside Almudena Cathedral, Bishop Valdespino had momentarily stopped breathing. He still wore his ceremonial robes and was seated at his office laptop, riveted by the images being transmitted from Bilbao. This will be a massive news story. From all he could see, the global media were already going wild. The top news outlets were lining up authorities on science and religion to speculate about Kirsch's presentation, while everyone else offered hypotheses as to who murdered Edmund Kirsch and why. The media seemed to concur that, by all appearances, someone out there was deadly serious about making sure Kirsch's discovery never saw the light of day. After a long moment of reflection, Valdespino took out his cell phone and placed a call. Rabbi Kirvish answered on the first ring.
Terrible!
The rabbi's voice was nearly a shriek.
I was watching on television. We need to go to the authorities right now and tell them what we know.
Rabbi, Valdespino replied, his tone measured. I agree this is a horrifying turn of events, but before we take action, we need to think.
There is nothing to think about,
Kirvish fired back.
Clearly someone will stop at nothing to bury Kirsch's discovery, and they are butchers. I am convinced they also killed Syed. They must know who we are and will be coming for us next. You and I have a moral obligation to go to the authorities and tell them what Kirsch told us.
A moral obligation? Valdespino challenged. It sounds more like you want to make the information public so nobody has a motive to silence you and me personally.
Certainly our safety is a consideration, the rabbi argued. But we also have a moral obligation to the world. I realize this discovery will call into question some fundamental religious beliefs, but if there is one thing I have learned in my long life, it is that faith always survives. Even in the face of great hardship, I believe faith will survive this too, even if we reveal Kirsch's findings.
I hear you, my friend, the bishop finally said, maintaining as even a tone as possible. I can hear the resolution in your voice, and I respect your thinking. I want you to know that I am open to discussion, and even to being swayed in my thinking. And yet, I beseech you, if we are going to unveil this discovery to the world, let us do it together, in the light of day, with honor, not in desperation on the heels of this horrific assassination. Let us plan it, rehearse it, and frame the news properly. Kirvish said nothing, but Valdespino could hear the old man breathing.
Rabbi, the bishop continued, at the moment the single most pressing issue is our personal safety. We are dealing with killers, and if you make yourself too visible, for example by going to the authorities or to a television station, it could end violently. I'm fearful for you in particular. I have protection here inside the palace complex, but you are alone in Budapest. Clearly, Kirsch's discovery is a life and death matter. Please let me arrange for your protection, Yehuda.
Kirvish fell silent a moment.
From Madrid? How can you possibly...
I have the security resources of the royal family at my disposal. Remain inside your home with your doors locked. I will request that 2 Guardia Real agents collect you and bring you to Madrid. where we can make sure you are safe in the palace complex, and where you and I can sit down face to face and discuss how best to move forward.
If I come to Madrid, the rabbi said tentatively, what if you and I cannot agree on how to proceed?
We will agree, the bishop assured him. I know I am old-fashioned, but I am also a realist, like yourself. Together we will find the best course of action. I have faith in that.
And if your faith is misplaced? Kirvish pressed.
Valdespino felt his stomach tighten, but he paused a moment, exhaled, and replied as calmly as he could.
Yehuda,
if in the end you and I cannot find a way to proceed together, then we will part as friends, and we will each do what we feel is best. You have my word on that.
Thank you, Kirvish replied. On your word, I will come to Madrid.
Good. In the meantime, lock your doors and speak to no one. Pack a bag, and I'll call you with details when I have them.
Valdespino paused.
And have faith. I'll see you very soon.
Valdespino hung up, a feeling of dread in his heart. He suspected that continuing to control Kirvish would require more than a plea for rationality and prudence.
Kirvish is panicking, just like Syed. Both of them fail to see the bigger picture.
Valdespino closed his laptop, tucked it under his arm, and made his way through the darkened sanctuary. Still wearing his ceremonial robes, he exited the cathedral into the cool night air and headed across the plaza toward the gleaming white facade of the royal palace. Above the main entrance, Valdespino could see the Spanish coat of arms, a crest flanked by the pillars of Hercules and the ancient motto, Plus Ultra, meaning further beyond. Some believed the phrase referred to Spain's centuries-long quest to expand the empire during its golden age. Others believed it reflected the country's long-held belief that a life in heaven existed beyond this one. Either way, Valdespino sensed the motto was less relevant every day. As he eyed the Spanish flag flying high above the palace, he sighed sadly, his thoughts turning back to his ailing king.
I will miss him when he's gone. I owe him so much.
For months now, the bishop had made daily visits to his beloved friend, who was bedridden in Palacio de la Zarzuela, on the outskirts of the city. A few days ago, the king had summoned Valdespino to his bedside, a look of deep concern in his eyes.
Antonio, the king had whispered, I fear my son's engagement was rushed.
Insane is a more accurate description, Valdespino thought. 2 months earlier, when the prince had confided in Valdespino that he intended to propose marriage to Ambra Vidal, after knowing her only a very short time, the stupefied bishop had begged Julian to be more prudent. The prince had argued that he was in love and that his father deserved to see his only son married. Moreover, he said, if he and Ambra were to have a family, her age would require that they not wait too long. Valdespino calmly smiled down at the king.
Yes, I agree. Don Julian's proposal took us all by surprise, but he only wanted to make you happy.
His duty is to his country, the king said forcefully, not to his father. And while Ms. Vidal is lovely, she is an unknown to us, an outsider. I question her motives in accepting Don Julian's proposal. It was far too hasty, and a woman of honor would have rejected him.
You are correct, Valdespino replied, although in Umbra's defense, Don Julian had given her little choice.
The king gently reached out and took the bishop's bony hand in his own.
My friend, I don't know where the time has gone. You and I have grown old. I want to thank you. You have counseled me wisely through the years, through the loss of my wife, through the changes in our country, and I have benefited greatly from the strength of your conviction.
Our friendship is an honor I will treasure forever.
The king smiled weakly.
Antonio, I know you have made sacrifices in order to stay with me. Rome, for one.
Baldespino shrugged.
Becoming a cardinal would have brought me no closer to God.
My place has always been here with you.
Your loyalty has been a blessing.
And I will never forget the compassion you showed me all those years ago.
The king closed his eyes, gripping the bishop's hand tightly.
Antonio, I am concerned. My son will soon find himself at the helm of a massive ship, a ship he is not prepared to navigate. Please guide him. Be his pole star. Place your steady hand atop his on the rudder, especially in rough seas. Above all, when he goes off course, I beg you to help him find his way back, back to all that is pure.
Amen, the bishop whispered. I give you my word.
Now, in the cool night air, as Valdespino made his way across the plaza, he raised his eyes to the heavens.
Your Majesty, please know that I am doing all I can to honor your final wishes.
Valdespino took solace in knowing that the king was far too weak now to watch television. If he had seen tonight's broadcast out of Bilbao, he would have died on the spot to witness what his beloved country had come to. To Valdespino's right, beyond the iron gates, all along Calle de Bailén, media trucks had gathered and were extending their satellite towers.
Vultures, Valdespino thought, the evening air whipping at his robes.
Chapter 25.
There will be time to mourn, Langdon told himself, fighting back intense emotion. Now is the time for action.
Langdon had already asked Winston to search museum security feeds for any information that might be helpful in apprehending the shooter. Then he had quietly added that Winston should search for any connections between Bishop Valdespino and Avila. Agent Fonseca was returning now, still on the phone.
Sí, sí, he was saying. Claro. Inmediatamente.
Fonseca ended the call and turned his attention to Ambra, who stood nearby, looking dazed.
Miss Vidal, we're leaving,
Fonseca announced, his tone sharp.
Don Julian has demanded that we get you to safety inside the royal palace at once.
Ambra's body tensed visibly.
I'm not abandoning Edmund like that.
She motioned to the crumpled corpse beneath the blanket.
Local authorities will be taking over this matter, Fonseca replied, and the coroner is on his way. Mr. Kirsch will be handled respectfully and with great care. At the moment, we need to leave. We're afraid you're in danger.
I am most certainly not in danger,
Umbra declared, stepping toward him.
An assassin just had the perfect opportunity to shoot me and did not. Clearly he was after Edmund.
Miss Vidal,
the veins in Fonseca's neck twitched.
The prince wants you in Madrid. He is worried about your safety.
No, she fired back. He's worried about the political fallout.
Fonseca exhaled a long, slow breath and lowered his voice.
Miss Vidal, what happened tonight has been a terrible blow for Spain. It has also been a terrible blow for the prince. Your hosting tonight's event was an unfortunate decision.
Winston's voice spoke suddenly inside Langdon's head.
Professor, the museum security team has been analyzing the building's external camera feeds. It appears they've found something.
Langdon listened and then waved a hand at Fonseca,
interrupting the agent's reprimand of Umbra. "Sir, the computer said one of the museum's rooftop cameras got a partial photo of the top of the getaway car."
"Oh?"
Fonseca looked surprised. Langdon relayed the information as Winston gave it to him. "A black sedan leaving the service alley. License plates not legible from that high angle. An unusual sticker on the windshield."
"What sticker?" Fonseca demanded. "We can alert local authorities to look for it."
"The sticker," Winston replied in Langdon's head, "is not one I recognized, but I compared its shape to all known symbols in the world, and I received a single match." Langdon was amazed how fast Winston had been able to make all this happen. "The match I received," Winston said, "was for an ancient alchemical symbol. Amalgamation."
"I beg your pardon?"
Langdon had expected the logo of a parking garage or a political organization.
"The car sticker shows the symbol for amalgamation?"
Fonseca looked on, clearly lost.
"There must be some mistake, Winston," Langdon said. "Why would anyone display the symbol for an alchemical process?"
"I don't know," Winston replied. "This is the only match I got, and I'm showing 99% correspondence." Langdon's eidetic memory quickly conjured the alchemical symbol for amalgamation. "Winston, describe exactly what you see in the car window." The computer replied immediately, "The symbol consists of one vertical line crossed by three transverse lines. On top of the vertical line sits an upward-facing arch."
"Precisely," Langdon frowned.
"The arch on top, does it have capstones?"
"Yes. A short horizontal line sits on top of each arm."
"Okay, then. It's amalgamation."
Langdon puzzled for a moment. "Winston, can you send us the photo from the security feed?"
"Of course."
"Send it to my phone," Fonseca demanded.
Langdon relayed the agent's cell phone number to Winston, and a moment later Fonseca's device pinged. They all gathered around the agent and looked at the grainy black and white photo. It was an overhead shot of a black sedan in a deserted service alley. Sure enough, in the lower left-hand corner of the windshield, Langdon could see a sticker displaying the exact symbol Winston had described.
Amalgamation. How bizarre.
Puzzled, Langdon reached over and used his fingertips to enlarge the photo on Fonseca's screen. Leaning in, he studied the more detailed image. Immediately, Langdon saw the problem.
"It's not amalgamation," he announced.
Although the image was very close to what Winston had described, it was not exact. And in symbology, the difference between close and exact could be the difference between a Nazi swastika and a Buddhist symbol of prosperity. This is why the human mind is sometimes better than a computer.
"It's not one sticker," Langdon declared. "It's two different stickers overlapping a bit. The sticker on the bottom is a special crucifix called the Papal Cross. It's very popular right now."
With the election of the most liberal pontiff in Vatican history, thousands of people around the globe were showing their support for the Pope's new policies by displaying the Triple Cross, even in Langdon's hometown of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
"The U-shaped symbol on top," Langdon said, "is a separate sticker entirely."
"I now see you are correct," Winston said. "I'll find the phone number for the company."
Again, Langdon was amazed by Winston's speed.
"He's already identified the company logo?"
"Excellent," Langdon said. "If we call them, they can track the car." Fonseca looked bewildered.
"Track the car? How?"
"This getaway car was hired," Langdon said, pointing to the stylized U on the windshield.
"It's an Uber." Chapter 26. From the look of wide-eyed disbelief on Fonseca's face, Langdon couldn't tell what surprised the agent more, the quick decryption of the windshield sticker
or Admiral Avila's odd choice of getaway car. He hired an Uber, Langdon thought, wondering if the move was brilliant or incredibly short-sighted. Uber's ubiquitous on-demand driver service had taken the world by storm over the past few years. Via smartphone, anyone requiring a ride could instantly connect with a growing army of Uber drivers who made extra money by hiring out their own cars as improvised taxis. Only recently legalized in Spain, Uber required its Spanish drivers to display Uber's U logo on their windshields. Apparently, the driver of this Uber getaway car was also a fan of the new Pope. "Agent Fonseca," Langdon said, "Winston says he has taken the liberty of sending the image of the getaway car to local authorities to distribute at roadblocks." Fonseca's mouth fell open, and Langdon sensed that this highly trained agent was not accustomed to playing catch-up. Fonseca seemed uncertain whether to thank Winston or tell him to mind his own damn business. "And he is now dialing Uber's emergency number."
"No," Fonseca commanded. "Give me the number. I'll call myself. Uber will be more likely to assist a senior member of the Royal Guard than they will a computer."
Langdon had to admit Fonseca was probably right. Besides, it seemed far better that the Guardia assist in the manhunt than waste their skills transporting Umbra to Madrid. After getting the number from Winston, Fonseca dialed, and Langdon felt rising confidence that they might catch the assassin in a matter of minutes. Locating vehicles was at the heart of Uber's business. Any customer with a smartphone could literally access the precise locations of every Uber driver on Earth. All Fonseca would need to do was ask the company to locate the driver who had just picked up a passenger behind the Guggenheim Museum.
"Hostia," Fonseca cursed. "Automatizada."
He stabbed at a number on his keypad and waited, apparently having reached an automated list of menu options.
"Professor, once I get through to Uber and order a trace on the car, I will be handing this matter over to local authorities so Agent Diaz and I can transport you and Ms. Vidal to Madrid."
"Me?" Langdon replied, startled. "No, I can't possibly join you."
"You can, and you will," Fonseca declared. "As will your computer toy," he added, pointing to Langdon's headset.
"I'm sorry," Langdon responded, his tone hardening. "There is no way I can accompany you to Madrid."
"That's odd," Fonseca replied. "I thought you were a Harvard professor."
Langdon gave him a puzzled look. "I am."
"Good," Fonseca snapped. "Then I assume you're smart enough to realize you have no choice."
With that, the agent stalked off, returning to his phone call. Langdon watched him go. What the hell?
"Professor?"
Umbra had stepped very close to Langdon and whispered behind him.
"I need you to listen to me. It's very important."
Langdon turned, startled to see that Umbra's expression was one of profound fear. Her mute shock seemed to have passed, and her tone was desperate and clear.
"Professor," she said, "Edmund showed you enormous respect by featuring you in his presentation. For this reason, I'm going to trust you. I need to tell you something."
Langdon eyed her, uncertain.
"Edmund's murder was my fault," she whispered, her deep brown eyes welling with tears.
"I beg your pardon?" Umbra glanced nervously at Fonseca, who was now out of earshot.
"The guest list," she said, returning to Langdon. "The last-minute addition. The name that was at it?"
"Yes, Luis Avila."
"I am the person who added that name," she confessed, her voice cracking. "It was me."
Winston was correct, Langdon thought, stunned.
"I'm the reason Edmund was murdered," she said, now on the verge of tears. "I let his killer inside this building."
"Hold on," Langdon said, placing a hand on her trembling shoulder. "Just talk to me. Why did you add his name?" Umbra shot another anxious glance at Fonseca, who was still on the phone 20 yards away.
"Professor, I received a last-minute request from someone I trust deeply,"
He asked me to add Admiral Avila's name to the guest list as a personal favor. The request came only minutes before the doors opened, and I was busy, so I added the name without thinking. I mean, he was an admiral in the Navy. How could I possibly have known?
She looked again at Edmund's body and covered her mouth with a slender hand.
And now?
Ambra, Langdon whispered, who was it that asked you to add Avila's name?
Ambra swallowed hard.
It was my fiancé, the Crown Prince of Spain, Don Julian.
Langdon stared at her in disbelief, trying to process her words. The director of the Guggenheim had just claimed that the Crown Prince of Spain had helped orchestrate the assassination of Edmund Kirsch.
That's impossible.
I'm sure the palace never expected I would learn the killer's identity, she said. But now that I know, I fear I'm in danger.
Langdon put a hand on her shoulder. You're perfectly safe here.
No, she whispered forcefully. There are things going on here that you don't understand. You and I need to get out. Now.
We can't run, Langdon countered. We'll never...
Please listen to me, she urged. I know how to help Edmund.
I'm sorry? Langdon sensed that she was still in shock. Edmund can't be helped.
Yes, he can, she insisted, her tone lucid. But first, we'll need to get inside his home in Barcelona.
What are you talking about?
Please just listen to me carefully. I know what Edmund would want us to do.
For the next 15 seconds, Ambra Vidal spoke to Langdon in hushed tones. As she talked, Langdon felt his heart rate climbing. My God, he thought. She's right. This changes everything. When she was finished, Ambra looked up at him defiantly.
Now do you see why we need to go?
Langdon nodded without hesitation. Winston, he said into his headset, did you hear what Ambra just told me?
I did, Professor.
Were you already aware of this?
No.
Langdon considered his next words very carefully.
Winston, I don't know if computers can feel loyalty to their creators, but if you can, this is your moment of truth. We could really use your help.
Chapter 27. As Langdon moved toward the podium, he kept one eye on Fonseca, who was still engrossed in his phone call to Uber. He watched as Ambra drifted casually toward the center of the dome, talking on her phone, too, or at least pretending to talk, precisely as Langdon had suggested.
Tell Fonseca you decided to call Prince Julian.
As Langdon reached the podium, he reluctantly turned his gaze to the crumpled form on the floor. Edmund. Gently, Langdon pulled back the blanket that Ambra had placed over him. Edmund's once bright eyes were now two lifeless slits below a crimson hole in his forehead. Langdon shuddered at the gruesome image, his heart pounding with loss and rage. For an instant, Langdon could still see the young mop-haired student who had entered his class full of hope and talent and had gone on to accomplish so much in so brief a time. Horrifically, tonight, someone had murdered this astonishingly gifted human being, almost certainly in an attempt to bury his discovery forever. And unless I take bold action, Langdon knew, my student's greatest accomplishment will never see the light of day. Positioning himself so that the podium was partially blocking Fonseca's line of sight, Langdon knelt down beside Edmund's body, closed his eyes, folded his hands together, and assumed the reverent posture of prayer. The irony of praying over an atheist almost caused Langdon to smile.
Edmund, I know that you of all people don't want anyone praying for you. Don't worry, my friend. I'm not actually here to pray.
As he knelt over Edmund, Langdon fought a rising fear. I assured you the bishop was harmless. If Valdespino turns out to be involved in this...
Langdon pushed it from his mind.
Once he felt certain that Fonseca had spotted him praying, Langdon very discreetly leaned forward and reached inside Edmund's leather jacket, removing his oversized turquoise phone. He glanced quickly back toward Fonseca, who was still on the phone and now seemed less interested in Langdon than he did in Ambra, who appeared to be engrossed in her own phone call and was wandering farther and farther away from Fonseca. Langdon returned his eyes to Edmund's phone and took a calming breath. One more thing to do. Gently, he reached down and lifted Edmund's right hand. It already felt cold. Bringing the phone to his fingertips, Langdon carefully pressed Edmund's index finger to the fingerprint recognition disc. The phone clicked and unlocked. Langdon quickly scrolled to the settings menu and disabled the password protection feature. Permanently unlocked. Then he slipped the phone into his jacket pocket and covered Edmund's body again with the blanket. Sirens wailed in the distance as Ambra stood alone in the center of the deserted auditorium and held her cell phone to her ear, pretending to be absorbed in a conversation, all the while very aware of Fonseca's eyes on her.
Hurry, Robert.
A minute ago, the American professor had leaped into action after Ambra had shared with him a recent conversation she'd had with Edmund Kirsch. Ambra told Langdon that two nights ago, in this very room, she and Edmund had been working late on the final details of the presentation when Edmund had taken a break to have his third spinach smoothie of the night. Ambra had noticed how exhausted he looked.
"I've got to say, Edmund," she had said, "I'm not sure this vegan diet is working for you. You're looking pale and much too thin."
"Too thin?" he laughed. "Look who's talking."
"I'm not too thin."
"Borderline." He winked playfully at her indignant expression. "As for my being pale, give me a break. I'm a computer geek who sits all day in the glow of an LCD screen."
"Well, you're addressing the entire world in 2 days, and a little color would do you some good. Either get outside tomorrow or invent a computer screen that gives you a tan."
"That's not a bad idea," he said, looking impressed. "You should patent that." He laughed, and then returned his attention to the matter at hand.
"So you're clear on the order of events for Saturday night?"
Ambra nodded, glancing down at the script.
"I welcome people inside the anteroom, and then we all move into this auditorium for your introductory video, after which you magically appear at the podium over there."
She pointed to the front of the room.
"And then, at the podium, you make your announcement."
"Perfect," Edmund said, "with one small addition." He grinned. "When I speak at the podium, it will be more of an intermission, a chance for me to welcome my guests in person, let everyone stretch their legs and prep them a bit more before I begin the second half of the evening, a multimedia presentation that explains my discovery."
"So the announcement itself is pre-recorded? Like the intro?"
"Yes, I just finished it a few days ago. We're a visual culture. Multimedia presentations are always more gripping than some scientist talking at a podium."
"You're not exactly just some scientist," Ambra said, "but I agree. I can't wait to see it."
For security purposes, Ambra knew, Edmund's presentation was stored on his own private, trusted off-site servers. Everything would be live-streamed into the museum projection system from a remote location.
"When we're ready for the second half," she asked, "who will activate the presentation, you or me?"
"I'll do it myself," he said, pulling out his phone. "With this." He held up his oversized smartphone with its turquoise Gaudi case. "It's all part of the show. I simply dial into my remote server on an encrypted connection." Edmund pressed a few buttons, and the speakerphone rang once and connected. A computerized female voice answered,
"Good evening, Edmund. I am awaiting your password."
Edmund smiled. And then, with the whole world watching, I simply type my password into my phone, and my discovery is live-streamed to our theater here and simultaneously to the entire world.
Sounds dramatic, Umbra said, impressed. Unless, of course, you forget.